and we are very happy today to have Gautam
Satishchandran from Princeton that's going to talk about Horizon or Washington.
Okay, thanks for the introduction. Thanks for the invitation. So what I'll be talking about today, are a sequence of Gedanken experiments. That's a really good way of, I think, putting them. The first one, which was the one that kicked everything off, was actually one in flat space-time, no horizons, nothing. I'll be talking about that in the beginning. Then we kind of just asked ourselves, what happens if I, do this same Gedanken experiment outside of a black hole? That's what the subject of this essay was. And then we fully generalized this effect that we found to all horizons. Okay, so that's the general idea, and hopefully by the end you're convinced of the title. Okay, that sounds good. So before I kind of get into the whole, weeds of what I'll be talking about, since I'm at the quantum gravity seminar and, you guys think about quantum gravity a lot, let me just kind of give a bigger overview of the general thought process and idea here. Well, the subject of quantum gravity has been debated for, many years. It was debated, quite seriously as early as the 50s at this Chapel Hill conference where Wheeler and DeWitt and Feynman were all in attendance. And what they were, interested in is, many people were trying to construct a kind of ground-up theory of quantum gravity, postulating some basic rules or principles and deriving some theory. Feynman kind of interjects, and I highly recommend just looking at the transcript of this conference. He really just interjects at some point and says, we really don't know maybe what the fundamental rules are of quantum gravity, what the local observables are, if there are any, or anything. But it might be useful to consider situations where both quantum theory and gravity both play an essential role. And then what do? Well, you use the well-understood rules of the quantum theory to then infer properties about the fundamental theory. So immediately, and as was asked at that conference, he was asked to give an example. And kind of off the top of his head, he brought up the example of, if I have a quantum body, some wave function, and I put it in a spatial superposition of two spatially separated states, like one on the left and half probability of being on the right, what he asked the audience was, what is the gravitational field of such a body? Well, undoubtedly, and if I polled this audience, I think you would all agree that the gravitational field of such a body, even in the simple scenario, should also be in a superposition. And the idea was that even in this elementary case, you need quantum gravity to even describe, what is going on in this kind of simple system. So basically, what I'll be doing in this talk, so I should mention that this is a, this was a Gedanken experiment in the 1950s. It, as of 2017, has been proposed and is seriously being worked on by Marcus Aspelmeyer in Vienna to be an actual experiment to show that the gravitational field can be put in such a superposition. But everything that I'll be talking about in my talk is fully a Gedanken experiment. I'm not proposing, don't go writing proposals based off of what I'm saying today. But in the same spirit of Feynman, what we're going to show is that such Gedanken experiments really provide insights, into the nature, as we'll see, of horizons and decoherence of quantum systems. Okay? And it will really, I think, give some insight into such relationship in a quantum theory of gravity. Okay? So are we all on board with the kind of overall picture of what the idea is? I haven't given any specific details of what the Gedanken experiments are, which I'll do now. And what I'm going to start with is a Gedanken experiment fully in flat space-time. And instead of the gravitational case, let's all analyze the electromagnetic version first. There's a gravitational analog, but it's so much simpler first to think about the electromagnetic case. Okay? And we're going to have an experimenter, and we're in the Bob room, but this will be Alice. And Alice is going to create such a 50-50 spatial superposition that I told you about before. Half probability of her particle being on the right, half probability of her particle being on the left. This is particle need not be an elementary particle. It could be a nanoparticle or an atom. I just only want to keep track of its center of mass degrees of freedom. I don't want to have to worry about any other degrees of freedom just for this particular problem. I mean, one could extend this Gedanken experiment for sure. And this particle is going to have charge Q, and she's a really good experimentalist. She's going to maintain the superposition for a very long time, and at some predetermined time, she's going to recombine the particle back together. Okay? So if you're confused already, let me just give you a space-time diagram. So way, when she started her PhD, she created this superposition. What a remarkable feat. She should certainly win a Nobel Prize on her own, but she's going to keep going. And she's going to maintain this superposition of a size d for a very long time. When she reaches this point, this time, she had her committee meeting. She's going to recombine the particle back together. And you could ask, how could you do this? This is achievable. For example, the earliest known example is a Stern-Gerlach apparatus. If her particle had spin in the x direction, let's say, she passes it through a Stern-Gerlach apparatus, it'll go into a 50-50 spatial superposition of spin up in the z direction and to the right, or spin down in the z direction and to the left. She maintains that for a very long time and then flips her Stern-Gerlach apparatus upside down, recombines the beams back together, and she's going to check for the coherence of her particle at the end. How would she check? She would just measure the spin in the x direction. If it's a fully coherent superposition, she should always see spin up in the x direction as she started out with her particle. If she ever sees spin down in the x direction, she knows she's at least partially decohered. Does everyone understand the protocol for Alice's experiment? Speak now. Okay. I mean, feel free to ask more questions. So, okay, why would I be worried about Alice's coherence? Well, Alice has an office mate, which is Bob, and Bob does not want Alice to graduate. Okay, so Bob has what he's decided to do, and he doesn't want to be caught, right? So he doesn't want to go over and poke Alice, one branch of Alice's superposition and try to decohere her. He's going to be a little bit more clever. He's going to release a particle from a trap. He is a test particle in a trap, and he's going to release it at space-like separation from Alice's recombination. Okay, I'll show you the diagram in a second. But he's going to release it at space-like separation. And what does he see? He doesn't know that Alice is recombining. He just sees the two Coulomb fields of either Alice's particle going to the right or going to the left. His particle gets displaced more or less, depending on if it feels either Coulomb field. And if he can get a big enough possible displacement of his particle in either one direction or the other, his particle will be entangled with Alice's superposition. So let me show you a space-time diagram. So what does he see? He sees the Coulomb field of Alice's particle going on the right, or the Coulomb field of Alice's particle on the left. That's all he sees in this region. His particle will get displaced differently based on which path Alice went on. And if his particle is displaced significantly enough, which if Alice's charge is big enough, there's no reason why he can't make this measurement of which path Alice went on. And then he's going to, if a particle can make this measurement, it's going to be entangled with which path Alice went on. And that's his strategy for decohering Alice. Does everyone understand what Bob is doing? Okay.
Can I just ask, surely in that setup, any observation whatsoever of the electromagnetic field is going to
partially decohere you. Yeah. So the key is, it's any observation that can distinguish which path. Yeah. If you make a measurement that can't distinguish which path, like for example, well, Bob could just measure the position of his box, for example, that's not going to decohere Alice, right? So it needs to be a measurement that determines which path Alice went on. Thank you for the question. Okay, so you all should be upset right now, to some degree. Well, the two words that you could use to describe how upset you are one is complementarity. What is that? That just means that if Bob's particle can become entangled with which path Alice went on, then Alice's particle is entangled with Bob's particle. That's just the statement of quantum mechanics. And therefore, if Bob can get some which path information, become entangled, then Alice's particle must be decohered to some degree, commensurately. However, and you know, most of you who are nodding along, by causality, Bob should not be able to influence the coherence of Alice's particle at all. Okay, so what's going on here? Is everyone upset? Okay, good. So
something like this happens in Bell inequality violations also, right?
But they don't have to ever meet up for this decoherence to occur, the one I'm talking about. It's different than a Bell. This is before, so Alice is decohered before meeting up with knowing whether Bob made a measurement or not.
But at some point, the thing that he started from was kind of entangled with the...
No, the box was such that Bob made this box before Alice started her PhD. And he's kept this box around and he opened it at this time. So the box is a confining potential such that he's not influenced or entangled with Alice's particle.
Maybe my question is just like, if I look at the propagation of like changes in the Coulombic fields of these different particles, are you saying that like he had the box was like a Faraday cage or something?
In the electromagnetic, but it just needs to be a confining potential that just doesn't allow Bob's particle to become entangled with Alice's Alice's particle.
Yeah, but the reason for me not being upset is because even in the Bell inequality violation measurement, you can always see that one particle influences something outside its light cone. It's just the signaling cannot happen.
Yeah, so they have now. So if Bob can make this measurement, if he can get which path information, Alice, I'm claiming, is decohered. Whether or not Alice, well, the question is, can she convict Bob in court? But that is, from what I've just described so far, not obviously true why she can't convict Bob in court for doing that measurement. If in the absence of Bob, would you say that she can recombine the particle and make a measurement and everything's cohered? Then she can argue that someone at space-like separation decohered her. Okay, that's all I'm saying.
But the Coulomb fields are causal.
The Coulomb fields are causal.
What's wrong with...
Well, that's the key. That's the question. So is everyone confused in the right way? Whenever I give this talk, I don't know if people are confused in the wrong way, in the sense that they're not following, or... Okay, anyway, so... But I keep asking questions. But, I mean, the...
superposition of the right conclusion and the wrong...
Yeah. Well, hopefully the people in that superposition are also in a different room. That's the other... Okay, so...
Intuition, I would say that by the time he made that experiment, he shouldn't have been able to see any changes in the actual classical field, right?
There's a superposition of Coulomb fields in Bob's region.
Yeah.
And he is just trying to make a measurement of those fields. And if those Coulomb fields are sufficiently strong enough, like the size of the Alice's superposition is big enough, or the charge is big enough, I claim he can make that measurement.
Oh, maybe my dumb question. Yeah. Like the Coulomb field say she created that entangled pair like a long time ago, right?
Yeah.
And that field is already causally propagated.
It's fully set up in Bob's region.
Sure. So
yeah.
Why is that surprising then if whatever combination is, because why not?
Because in the he can make a measurement of the field and Alice, he can choose to make a measurement or not in the space-like separation, and Alice will be decohered or not, depending on whether or not what Bob does.
Sure, but the state that she prepared was prepared far enough into the past that he can see that.
Yeah, so it's fine, except for the fact that now they can use this to transmit information faster than the speed of light, which is definitely not fine. I mean, that's definitely not, that can't be the case. That can't be the resolution. That's not a resolution. That's a pointing out of the problem.
It's not Bob making the the measurement.
Bob can choose, yes.
Instantly.
Alice does become correlated with Bob's particle. The question is, why is that consistent with causality?
Fine, as long as he can't tell
her
that.
Yeah.
But he can. He can choose to make a measurement or not. He can choose to open the box or not.
Yeah.
No, she will make. She will test the coherence of a particle before they become in causal contact.
But isn't that the same with any quantum? I thought that's the same
No, no, it's completely different.
He can send a message.
He can send a message. So now, say hi is opening a box, and goodbye is closing the box.
Yeah.
He's now able to either tell Alice hi or bye before they get in causal contact.
But he wouldn't know whether or not he
Well, that's all I'm saying. They know. Alice can make the measurement of the coherence of her particle.
No, wait. How can Bob communicate to Alice?
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying it's not possible, but I'm saying that from what I've told you right now, I need to justify why that's not possible. It's Bob is becoming correlated with the positions of Alice's particle.
Maybe the dumb question is when you have like the standard experiment and you have like two, like whatever, some like up, up, down, down, super position, and you send them far away. And
You're used to the fact that you need to go back and meet each other.
So, you could say that when this person measured it, that means the wave function here, like that's fine.
Yeah, but I'm making a local measurement here that is determining what Bob did. That's different than an EPR. The EPR is you can't make a local measurement that determines what the other person did.
If you knew that you were in a bell pair and you made a measurement at one qubit, then...
Maybe...
No. Well, no, I mean, it's important. Well, okay, let me get... there is a confusion, I think, So all I'm saying is Bob is becoming correlated with Alice, and Alice can figure out whether or not Bob opened the trap before they get in causal contact. That's obviously a paradox. I mean, you can try.
Paradox. That's my.
It's well, then resolve it with the EPR pair. There's no way to resolve it in the EPR manner.
But I think the only
they're staying out of causal contact for the entire duration of the experiment. There's no EPR is only resolved by coming back together and comparing qubits. But there, I'm saying there's a paradox well before they come into causal contact.
Yeah, maybe the origin of that entanglement is a causal, that's the point you're trying
to... The Coulomb field is set up in his region, and he's free to measure it or not. There's no a causality here.
Maybe I'll ask you.
Okay, so the key thing is that they're both making, as Ruth was mentioning, measurements of the electromagnetic field. And I'm not taking that into account. Al has to recombine her particle within a light travel time from Bob and is limited by the emission of entangling radiation on her own. She's got to recombine this particle very quickly before she gets into causal contact with Bob. So she's limited by entangling radiation. And Bob, he's trying to make a measurement of two different states of the electromagnetic field in his region. That's limited by local vacuum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field. It's not obvious that these two effects are exactly what you need, and that's what I'll explain on the next slide. But these are the only fundamental limitations on both Alice's and Bob's experiment. Okay? It looks like, Ted, you have a question. But I should probably move on. I mean, I'm only on the third slide at this point. So now, and this is going to be very useful in the black hole case, or any case, let's do a calculation. If the radiation state of Alice's particle going on the right is psi 1, and the radiation state of Alice's particle going on the left is psi 2, so I have these two radiation states, let's compute the amount of decoherence she suffers on her own without Bob even being there. Okay, and the way you calculate, if she makes two orthogonal radiation states, you know, if she really moves one path a lot more than the other path, then she will be fully decohered on her own. So if her radiation states are orthogonal with each other, this decoherence is one, whereas if she recombines in a manner where she doesn't radiate at all, the decoherence is going to be nearly zero. And you can quantify that by if you take the difference of those radiation fields and compute the expected number of photons, entangling photons is what you may call them, emitted out to, you know, out of her causal diamond that she's doing the experiment in, then she needs to ensure that she radiates less than an order one number of photons, entangling photons. Entangling photons being the difference of the radiation states going on the right path and the left path. And it's really easy by Larmor-type formula, because she's just accelerating the superposition back together, to estimate how many entangling photons she produces. She, you know, given this, her charge, the size of her superposition, and the time she needs to recombine. And if you want n to be less than 1, you need to give her a long enough time to recombine. If you give her too short of a time, she recombines and fully decoheres herself, even in the absence of Bob. Okay? Bob's particle is getting buffeted around by vacuum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field alone. And he needs to distinguish, you know, with the two different Coulomb fields in his region. And he needs a long enough time to do that as well. And so what one finds, and I'm summarizing basically an entire talk on its own, what one finds is that in order for the displacement of his particle to be bigger than the buffeting around by vacuum fluctuations, Alice's charge or size of her superposition must be sufficiently big enough. And these are now going to be contradictory statements on their own if they're at space-like separation.
Sorry, D is what? What is D?
Oh, D is the distance between Alice and Bob.
Okay. Yeah.
So the point is, in the case where Bob can make a measurement of the over in his region, Alice's charge is big enough, or the superposition is large enough, she has to recombine, you know, fairly quickly, and she decoheres herself. In the case where Alice recombines very, very slowly and is able to maintain coherence by emitting no radiation, Bob doesn't have enough time to make a measurement. Basically, if you look at this picture, I'm going to enlarge this diamond to be very, very big. That gives Alice enough time to recombine everything. But now Bob has a very short amount of time to distinguish two different states of the electromagnetic field in his region. And he just cannot. So you might be worried that this is not a totally general analysis because I'm doing it for a particular particle displacement measurement. If you want to see a fully general analysis for all possible measurements that Bob could possibly do at space-like separation, you know, see this paper that Dane and I wrote. Oh, I should have mentioned Dane is a graduate student, excellent graduate student with Bob.
Are you going to explain this further, or is this it for this?
So this is supposed to give you intuition. The intuition is basically that, well, let me finish this.
Phenomena behind it, but I don't, can you explain why the vacuum fluctuation scale is Q divided?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, that's basic. If you integrate, if you look at the mean squared fluctuations of the electromagnetic field, that scale is like 1/distance squared. And then when you, you're integrating over time, I guess, as well. But the key thing is that when you look at the fluctuations of the electromagnetic field and then ask how much is a particle displaced under those fluctuations, what you find is that they scale like Q over M. I mean, it's not an obvious calculation. You have to look at the fluctuations of the electromagnetic field in the vacuum. And they basically, they go like 1/...
Just not following the logic. You
yeah.
started out by saying, I thought correctly, that the size of the fluctuations depend on how much your localization scale you're looking at.
No, actually, no. The size of the fluctuations do, but you have to integrate the Lorentz force equation. And what you get is the size of the displacement due to the electromagnetic field is that your wave function is spread out to about the charge to mass ratio.
Q and M are the charge and mass of Bob's
particle. Yeah. Oh, I should have put a QB and an MB on that. My bad.
Maybe one question is like there could be other ways of measuring
Yes. Yeah. That's why I'm saying. I mean, this is valid for this particular measurement. There is a fully general resolution that I don't have time to give. That is for any measurement of the electromagnetic field at space-like separation, not just the a particle displacement measurement.
What is D? Little d? That was the Alice.
D is the size of the superposition of Alice's particle.
So how come Bob's inevitable fluctuations are related to Alice's?
Yeah, because he's trying. He has these fluctuations, and there's also a displacement of his particle due to the Coulomb field, right? Of Alice's particle being on the right or being on the left, and he's trying to have his particle get displaced more than the size of these vacuum fluctuations. So delta x is determined by Q and D, right? That's the amount that he's displaced. Let me go back. The amount that he's displaced is determined by Q and D. He wants delta x to be bigger than vacuum fluctuations.
QA? QA.
What? QA. QA.
Yeah. B and the other one's QA, right?
Yes. Yeah. So this is QB, and this is supposed to be QA. And I apologize for the confusion.
Different charges, so that they're okay or no?
No, because of a more general resolution that I don't have time to get to. But the intuition is the following that I hope to provide you now is that what we generally prove in this paper and what is true about this particle displacement measurement is that whenever Alice makes a superposition, she always must decohere herself at least as much as any Bobs could decohere her at space-like separation. That's what we generally prove in this paper, and that's the intuition that I'm trying to give you from this just particle displacement measurement.
The comment on this is that it's the number of photons, not doesn't depend on the energy.
Yeah, so that's an... Yeah. It can be very low frequency radiation, and we'll get to that in about a couple slides. But yes, what's important is the expected number of entangling photons, in the difference of the radiation things. Okay, so now, I mean, what is intuitively true is if Alice recombines very, very, very slowly, she can maintain coherence, and similarly, any Bob at space-like separation, I'm shrinking their regions under which they can make measurements and pushing them farther and farther away from my superposition in such a way that they cannot obtain any which path information. And that's the general resolution that we generally prove in this paper, and this is the intuition I'm trying to give. Does everyone understand the general lesson that of this slide?
Yeah.
Okay.
Prove it just using basically the axioms of quantum field theory?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So there's exactly. You relativistic quantum field theory. Yeah. Okay. So we published this paper, and Dane, roughly 2 days or something afterwards, asked, what happens if there's a black hole? And I maybe chuckled for a second and then got confused, and this became this talk. So you could ask yourself, what happens if there's a black hole is present and you have a sequence, a Bob or a sequence of Bobs. So this Bob is not Bob Wald, these Bobs are expendable Bobs. And I have them inside the black hole, and Alice is now doing her experiment way, way outside the black hole. But she's set up these Coulomb fields way so that they enter into the black hole. And Bob inside could try to measure inside the or Bobs, give as many Bobs as you'd like to try to measure the Coulomb field inside the black hole. So what am I saying? Well, the Bobs obviously cannot causally influence Alice, as I said before. And if the superposition of Alice's particle is maintained for a very long time, the Bobs inside should be able to accumulate arbitrarily good which path information. Imagine a very big black hole, and the Bobs are in there for a while. They're going to fall. They're going to die at some point, but put another one in and keep going.
No boning Bobs.
Yeah. So this is the space-time diagram that I want you to have in mind. I mean, this is not going to be so relevant that you know all the details, but this is the collapsing star that formed the black hole. That's going to play very little role until the end. This is the singularity, which is not going to play any role at all. This is the horizon. That's very important for this whole discussion. This is null infinity. This is the radiation field of the radiation that doesn't propagate into the black hole goes out to null infinity. And what I want to do is, Alice, now we got to give her more funding. Let's give her a whole lab with rockets on it that she can stay some fixed distance. She's not falling into the black hole. I want to do an optimal experiment. She's going to make this superposition, just as I said before, she's going to maintain it for an arbitrarily long amount of time, and then she's going to recombine it and check for the coherence at this time. Do we all see that she's just doing the same exact experiment, but now she's got to maintain the superposition just outside of a black hole? Is everyone on board with this? And what I'm saying is, what happens, I mean, she sets up these Coulomb fields of her particle either going to the right or to the left. If she's maintained it for a while, they are now measurable in the black hole region, and I could make a measurement of the Coulomb field in this region. And why doesn't that decohere, Alice?
Are you going to be able to say anything cool about like how hair on the horizon versus like hair at infinity?
Yes.
Can we actually be entangled with this?
Yes. Well, cool is you tell me if it's cool. what we'll now show. So the conclusion and the lesson I tried to give you on the last slide, and what we will now show is just true, is that black holes indeed harvest which path information about quantum superpositions in their exterior. And it's via the long-range Coulomb field that registers on the horizon. In particular, the presence of a black hole forces Alice to emit entangling soft photons and gravitons continually into the black hole. Nothing goes out to scry. She's going to maintain the superposition as slowly as she likes so that she doesn't accelerate too quickly and radiate anything to scry. We're giving her all the funding she wants. And this is, it's not going to be obvious that it does this, but it's going to result in a constant rate of decoherence of her superposition. And in a finite amount of time, her superposition will be fully decohered. And it's much faster than the black hole evaporation timescale. Okay, and quantitatively, what am I saying? I'm saying that if Alice maintains this superposition outside the black hole and then slowly recombines it, you know, over a very, very long time TA, well, she's going to radiate nothing to the null infinity. I'm going to make sure her timescales are longer than every timescale in the problem, so that she can make sure she doesn't radiate. But what must be the case in order for the causal consistency of the theory to be true is that she must radiate a lot of information into the black hole. And she must radiate a ton of which path information, and it must scale like the time that she maintains the superposition. And I will call that the decoherence due to the presence of the black hole. Is everyone on board? Yeah, go ahead.
In the previous example, you said that the longer time you give her, the better she can.
Yeah. This is not the case here.
And this is just the opposite.
It's the opposite. Yeah.
Sorry, can I ask you a question? So maybe I got a bit confused, but about the Alice decoherence here. You're talking about the self-decoherence of Alice, or...
She must decohere herself at least as much as any bobs at space-like separation can measure her.
Okay.
So she must decohere for the causal consistency of the theory. And what I'm concluding from the fact that there is in principle nothing stopping me except for, you know, me wanting to continue to live, of measuring the Coulomb field inside this black hole. Which means that Alice must be decohered a commensurate amount just by holding a superposition outside of a black hole.
But I mean, okay, so...
Without radiating anything to infinity.
But it's going to scale with some distance or something.
Yes, of course. Yeah, because the Coulomb field is harder to distinguish the farther and farther away I am.
Because if she doesn't decohere quick enough, then Bob can measure.
Exactly.
She's like really close to the horizon.
No, she can be arbitrarily far away, and the effect that I'll explain in a minute will depend on how far away she is from the horizon. But she just needs to be far away enough. The Coulomb field needs to register on the horizon of the black hole. If it registers, then I can make a measurement of it. And I can determine which path Alice went on. Okay, so maybe this is a slightly better or more familiar diagram maybe to some people, but this is now, you know, this just to represent more easily what's going on and introduce some coordinates because I want to do a calculation. So This is the black hole again. I've straightened things out a bit. Cross sections are spheres, capital indices are angles. And time on the black hole horizon is affine time. That's what I'll be taking it to be. This affine time on the horizon is proportional to this kind of killing time in Alice's lab. There's a redshift factor, but I'm assuming that Alice is far enough away that the redshift factor is order one. So she's like more than 3m away from the black hole, which is still, you know, this effect is going to be fast. I mean, is not going to be negligible even out for that far.
What would happen if, like, she was really close to the horizon? Do you see anything weird about you can't maintain quantum?
Well, so if you're let me just answer that. It's there is an effect when you're close to the horizon, but there's also like the Hawking temperature goes up by a ton, and so you don't want to. I mean, I want to just be at least away from where the redshift factor is order one. Okay, so, and I can talk about the Hawking temperature at the end if people are interested. So the key thing is that, so the affine time is related to the local time in Alice's lab by this kind of time dilation factor, and she's maintaining some constant distance measured in this proper distance off the horizon. Her lab is maintaining this constant distance from the horizon of the black hole. Okay? Okay, so let's just do the warm-up problem. Let's not do a quantum superposition. Let's just do a single body. And let's consider the case where I initially have a body located at some distance d from the horizon. And I'm going to slowly move it, as slowly as you like, to a new position displaced by little d. Okay? And the question, so this is the diagram. I have a body initially here, and I'm going to slowly displace it to a new position. And I'm going to do it so slowly that I radiate nothing to null infinity, absolutely nothing to null infinity. But now I want to know what is the quantum state on the horizon of the black hole. OK? And you might be worried, well, that's a quantum field. I want to know what the field is in curved space-time. That sounds very difficult. But there's a very simple formula for the Maxwell's equations on the horizon of the black hole, which relates the radial component of the electric field, that's the Coulomb field registered on the horizon of the black hole, to the horizon radiation. Basically, the radiation propagates into the black hole and oscillates transversely, which is angular, and falls into the black hole. So it relates this derivative operator is the derivative on the sphere. The divergence of the horizon radiation is related to the changes of any Coulomb field in the exterior. This is exactly the kind of formula I need to analyze the problem that I'm talking about, because I'm moving Coulomb fields outside a black hole. And for a static body, well, it doesn't radiate into the black hole or into at scry, and the horizon radiation is zero, and the Coulomb field is exactly what you would have expected, right? Just Q over the distance from the horizon squared. And now what I'm going to do is I want to analyze this process where I slowly move it to a new position. The time derivative of the Coulomb field is as small as you like, so the horizon radiation is very small. But you can't approximate it to be zero. The reason you can't is because if I integrate this equation, the right-hand side is the change in the Coulomb field from early to late times. That's not zero on the horizon of the black hole. And that means that the total integral of the electric field on the horizon is not zero.
So the horizon memory is playing the main...
Yes, it's playing the main role here.
So wait, does Andy... be right in the end. I'm sorry.
Well, you have to tell me the precise statement, and I probably yes. So now you might say, okay, that's not a big deal. I mean, this total integral is non-zero. Okay, I can't approximate it to be zero. But if you write the electric field in terms of the vector potential, which is what we're going to ultimately quantize, the electric field is the time derivative of the vector potential, and what this implies is that the vector potential on the horizon of the black hole must suffer a permanent change between early and late times. And those of you who are familiar with the memory effect at null infinity or came to my talk yesterday should see a kind of similarity between yesterday and today. This is on the horizon of the black hole. And what you find is that whatever you do, the vector potential on the horizon of the black hole for this process, no matter how slowly you move it, must look like this between early and late times. It must suffer a permanent change between early and late times, and the size of the change is determined by the change in the Coulomb field in the exterior.
Can I ask one more dumb question? Is when if I'm at infinity, normally I don't see different memory observables unless my particles are really moving with infinity.
Yeah. So
here it's a little distinct.
Yes.
Oh.
So it's a exactly. So well, I think I'm just answering your question and saying the answer is yes. So yes, you get an effect just by moving the body. So the horizon registers the fact that a body was moved from one position to the other. The energy of the photons is as low as you want, but there is an effect of the quantum state of the body from moving from one to the other. So we haven't quantized yet, but
how does the dimension of that work?
Yeah, so the dimension, well, I didn't put in the constants or something.
What constant?
So the key thing is that the electric field is the time. So do you agree with this expression, this and this? The electric field is the time derivative of the vector potential, and therefore if I integrate this equation, I get that the change in the vector angular component of the vector potential is proportional to the change in the Coulomb field.
Yeah, but
on the horizon.
I'm confused about the dimension, because that's the dimension of field right now, so I don't know.
Yeah, so I think there's a time factor that you, a factor of C that you need to go from electric field to vector potential.
No.
Right.
Length, right? If you already have a
function. Well, length, wait.
Yes. Electric field is just gradient of the.
There's.
So you need another length there. And
yeah, the length is. Oh, yeah, sorry. The length is coming from the fact that this divergence is on the sphere, on the horizon cross sections. And so there's a factor of black hole mass that I'm neglecting.
Like a horizon radius there.
Yeah, so I'm just giving a proportionality at the moment, but yes, the final formulas will have all of the constants in them.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Although maybe very small, I was just wondering if you took into account the fact that at a certain point the horizon will move slowly.
Yeah, due to Hawking evaporation?
No, on the other side, due to the fact that you are stuck in.
Yeah, so there's an energy flux due to the horizon. So if you're at the linearized gravitational level, or in the case where we're approximating the horizon to be a background, the Schwarzschild solution is a background and we're propagating quantum fields on it. If you allow for back reaction of the quantum fields onto the Schwarzschild geometry, then it will change, the horizon will move. That's a pretty negligible effect because of the fact that I'm radiating really, really low energy photons into the black hole, as arbitrarily low energy as you want. Okay, but I haven't told you what the number of photons as I mentioned before, that's what's key for determining whether or not Alice decoheres. And this is just an important bullet point on its own, I mean, regardless of the talk. So if you have a quantum state associated to a classical solution, that quantum state is a coherent state. And the expected number of photons in any coherent state above a chosen vacuum, you need to choose a vacuum to determine what the number of photons are, is given by the norm of the classical solution in the corresponding Hilbert space above that vacuum. Okay, so the formula is, if you give me a Hilbert space, I can compute the norm of the vector potential in that Hilbert space. That is, I'm claiming, equivalent to the expected number of photons in the corresponding coherent state associated to that classical solution. Okay, so that's just a formula. So now I can go ahead and calculate what the number of photons that I've emitted into the black hole. You had a question.
And I look at like the masses of the particles I've moved, you'll say that
there's a gravitational membrane. Yes. Yeah, at the linearized level at least, that's what we can calculate. Yeah. Okay, so how do you do that? This is probably the most technical bullet point, but you could also just believe me. So the vacuum state of, or a black hole formed from gravitational collapse, is what's called the Unruh vacuum. Okay? But at low frequencies, and this is supposed to be a citation to Candelas, I'm sorry for repeating putting the wrong citation, but at low frequencies, the Hartle-Hawking vacuum is equivalent to the Unruh vacuum. And the Hartle-Hawking vacuum is very nice because it's defined on the future horizon of the black hole. So given a classical solution on the future horizon of the black hole, I can compute its norm at low frequencies in the Hartle-Hawking vacuum, and that tells me the number of photons I need.
Yeah. So how can that be true, given that the Hartle-Hawking state has incoming photons that are unsuppressed if they're low frequency?
No, they are suppressed by the angular momentum barrier. They need to cross, they are suppressed.
Not by temperature, but by angular momentum.
By angular momentum barrier, yeah. Okay, so the formula for this norm that I need to calculate is that I take my classical solution, I Fourier transform it with respect to affine time, and square it and integrate over positive frequencies in all angles. That's the formula for this expected number of photons emitted during this process. Okay? And we're nearly done. Well, if the change in the vector potential between early and late times is non-zero, the Fourier transform must diverge at low frequencies like the Fourier transform of a step function. And consequently, the expected number of photons emitted in this process is logarithmically divergent at low frequencies. Okay, what is the lesson? If I take a charge outside of a black hole and displace it to a new position and leave it there forever, I emit I can do it as slowly as I like, I emit no photons to null infinity, but I emit an infinite number of soft horizon photons into the black hole. And the only difference is that if I'm not interested in displacing a charge and leaving it there forever, I need to bring it back to do a recombination experiment. If it's displaced back after a time capital T, then the expected number of photons will be finite, but large for large T. And this is the mechanism of the decoherence that resolves the paradox.
In its case, like log T or?
We'll see in a second, but no. Yeah, if it was log, it would be absolutely small. So it scales like log of V, where V is the affine time that I've displaced the particle. But as I mentioned before, the local time analysis lab is exponentially related to the affine time. And therefore, if I displace a particle outside a black hole, I accumulate a number of expected number of soft horizon photons fluxing into the horizon of the black hole at a constant rate, where now I've put the constants in and all the factors so that we can do an estimate. Okay, so we're nearly done. Am I good on time?
10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay, cool. Maybe I won't get to the whole cosmological case, but that's okay. We can talk about that later. So this is already good enough. So now I want to do a recombination experiment, but now I'm just going to have two such fields that are both accumulating soft photons onto the black hole. And if I take their difference, their expected number of photons will also just grow linearly in time. And as a result, the decoherence entirely due to the presence of the black hole, well, we know how to calculate it. It's given by the expected number of photons in the difference of the radiation states, which I just showed you is proportional to the time that I maintain the superposition. And after a certain amount of time, I will just have radiated an order one number of entangling soft photons into the black hole. And I will have fully decohered myself. If I radiate an order one number of photons, the decoherence due to the presence of the black hole is, you know, is exactly one. Okay? Do we all understand?
Sorry, could you go back to the formula? I'm just wondering the coefficient of T. What's setting the, let's see, a lot of different lengths go into that.
Yeah.
Radius cubed.
The Schwarzschild radius, this the distance.
Square,
yes.
Distance from black hole.
Yeah.
Is there some kind of intuitive?
Yeah, basically.
That combination of constants.
No, I don't have an interpretation. I mean, it's got to be that QD appears because I'm basically like Bob inside is trying to measure a dipole moment of the superposed electromagnetic field in his region. Like the monopole moment doesn't really, so QD has to be there. The distance has to come in. The fact that it comes to the sixth power is not total. I mean, it does come out from the calculation. but I don't have a better answer than.
Actually, I see what it is.
Okay.
Take the energy density in the dipole field of the superposition. This is sort of like what Penrose was proposing in his fundamental decoherence.
Uh-huh, yeah.
The energy density in the dipole field integrated over a volume that's the size of the black hole, and that is an energy, and you're multiplying that by T and dividing by H bar. That's what that coefficient is.
Okay, well, we should definitely talk about that more. I would be very interested in, I mean, that I'm not.
That's exactly what Penrose was proposing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so let me finish up here because I don't want to run over time too much. So if you take if you have, for example, a charged spatial superposition held outside of a black hole, well, you don't have to worry about this for the laboratory experiments I was telling you about in the first part of this talk. Because, well, this rate is very slow if you're far away from the black hole. So if you were doing this experiment on Earth and the sun was a black hole and you had an electron superposed over a meter, which is pretty big, but still not as large as the distance from the horizon of the black hole, then the time scale is very, very long. It's still shorter than the black hole evaporation time scale by quite a bit, but it's still very long. However, if you were at the ISCO, so the innermost stable orbit of the black hole around 6m, this decoherence time for the same size superposition would be 5 minutes. So if Alice superposes her electrons outside the black hole and tries to maintain it for longer than 5 minutes, she will find that she was fully decohered after that time. So she better finish her PhD quickly. And in the gravitational rate, by the same kind of analysis that I don't have time to give you, is exactly the same and gives, as you might expect, a much weaker or a slower rate just because of the fact that, you know, well, gravitons are in the game. And you need to get big superpositions in order for this to be the case. So if you have the Earth superposed over a distance of its own radius and the sun was a black hole, then it would decohere in exactly, you know, roughly 10 microseconds. And let me just say, for those writing proposals, it would not be easy to put the Earth in such a quantum superposition. So I have about 5 minutes left. Okay, so let me just say the exact same analysis, decomposition of Maxwell's equations, the production of soft photons, everything, holds for any killing, for any stationary superposition held outside of a killing horizon, where the notion of stationarity is determined by the killing flow. Okay? So that's exact same holds for a Rindler horizon in flat space time, which I can talk more about, the cosmological horizon in De Sitter. And let me just say a couple extra things. The key thing is that you have a stationary body that sources a long-range Coulomb field. That Coulomb field registers on the horizon of the black hole. When it registers, a quantum body sources a superposition of such Coulomb fields or Newtonian fields. And in this results, as we have just shown, in the constant rate of emission of soft photons and gravitons into the black hole. So even if your particle is neutral, it will still decohere just due to the fact that it's forced to radiate soft gravitons into the black hole. This means that the presence of any horizon in the vicinity of a quantum superposition will fully decohere the superposition in a finite time.
I'm sorry, can I ask you, how do you see that it's really the fact that it must be an horizon? Can it just be an observer that exerts a force, a pull toward you, such that to maintain it at distance d, you need a force in the other direction?
Let me actually answer your question right now. In the cosmological case, this occurs even for inertial superpositions. So it's really about the fact that you're having this long-range Coulomb field. So in the inertial if I am in my cosmological bubble, I'm at rest in the middle of my universe, I create the superposition, and the fact that I have emanated these long-range fields that go register on the cosmological horizon is what results in this decoherence. And you can estimate the rates, in the cosmological case. In De Sitter space-time, if I make a superposition of size d, with a horizon radius given by RH, the decoherence time in the electromagnetic and gravitational cases are given here. That's when Alice fully decoheres and she can never recombine the particle. Since the size of the superposition obviously must be much smaller than the size of the observable universe, this decoherence is much larger than the Hubble time unless the charge is much bigger than the Planck charge, so about 10 electrons, or the mass is much bigger than the Planck mass. And maybe I'll just conclude my talk soon. Let me just skip this slide and go to the end. Okay, so what is the punchline? Well, if you create a quantum superposition in the presence of a Killing horizon, the long-range fields of the superposition register on the horizon and result in this constant rate of decoherence. And thereby, the presence of any horizon harvests which path information as if it's measuring the superposition as I was giving you before. And eventually, a horizon will be able to determine which path information on any quantum superposition in its exterior. This effect is really due to the presence of the horizon. It's not due to the thermal radiation coming from the horizon. I didn't get a chance to talk about that, but I'd be happy to. We estimated that effect, and that's much suppressed relative to the effect that we're talking about and fully different. It's not related to the acceleration of Alice's lab. If her lab was, for example, outside of a star instead of a black hole, she can perform this experiment and recombine arbitrarily slowly in such a manner that she can maintain coherence. So this is due to the fact that you have these photons that must propagate across the Killing horizon, in this case of the black hole. So to conclude, we believe that in the spirit of Feynman, as I was mentioning in the beginning, the fact that black holes and cosmological horizons eventually decohere any quantum superposition in their vicinity may be of fundamental significance, while to our understanding of the nature of any horizon, in this particular case, Killing horizons, in a theory of quantum gravity. And with that, I think I'll conclude.
Can I ask a question from online?
Yeah.
Thank you. About this point of importance of horizon, I didn't understand why horizon is essential. Suppose I'm in flat Minkowski spacetime.
Yeah.
Not even cosmological spacetime. There's no expansion, just flat Minkowski spacetime.
Yeah, yeah.
And put a charged particle in macroscopic superposition.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that also lead to decoherence?
If Alice's lab is uniformly accelerating, that would result in decoherence in the manner that I've just basically described. You can calculate it two ways. One is just fully on the Rindler horizon, as I was just describing, in the same manner as the black hole case. Or you can just calculate in the standard, way you calculate things in using classical fields out to null infinity. We do both in the most recent paper, and you can show that they give the exact same rate. So if you have a superposition of electrons, that are uniformly accelerating, they are radiating inertial photons out to null infinity. But from the point of view of the Rindler horizon, those are soft. From the point of view of an inertial observer, who's not uniformly co-accelerating with Alice's lab, these photons are hard, but the number of photons are exactly the same in both cases.
The importance is that it has to be radiating. It's either due to acceleration or due to,
Say again?
Relative acceleration.
No, it's not, I don't know what you mean by relative acceleration, but it's the key thing is not Alice's lab accelerating. In flat space time, it is because that's the only way to get a horizon. But in general, that's not the key. Is not Alice's lab accelerating?
I was guessing it was essential because there has to be radiation. Now you're saying it's not. What is the key?
So radiation, it does not just come from acceleration. As I just showed you even for an inertial body in flat space-time, if I slowly displace it from one position, in De Sitter space-time, if I slowly displace it from one position to another, you know, very little relative acceleration between those two positions, they're going to decohere completely after a finite amount of time. So it's not due to, radiation is not always produced by acceleration, in this, especially soft radiation. Soft radiation is due to changing the Coulomb field from early to late times. In flat space time, your intuition is that...
Flat space time.
So there's no
acceleration.
It's just take
the particles into two positions in superposition and let it stay there, inertial.
But are they relatively boosted or not? I guess that's a key question.
No, they're relative. This distance stays the same.
Yeah. So then there's no reason why they should be decohered.
Right. Now you're saying the key isn't acceleration. Then why in this case?
Well, in flat space time, it is the case. It's basically the. In flat space, I'm saying it depends on the space-time because it depends on whether or not a horizon is present. So if you're restricting me to flat space-time, what's key in the flat space-time to get this effect is if Alice's lab is uniformly accelerating. But if Alice's lab is inertial, then she, as I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, she can do the recombination arbitrarily slowly and maintain coherence.
Right, okay. So we agree that in the flat space-time case, the key is acceleration.
In the flat space-time case, the key is acceleration. But that intuition won't help in the other space-times.
Suppose there's a black hole in this case.
I didn't hear the first part of that.
Suppose there is a black hole. Now we're in Schwarzschild.
Yeah.
Not space-time anymore. My guess... is that Bob stays inside of the black hole, and so he's accelerating with respect to Alice.
Sure.
And that's why there is decoherence. Are you saying this is wrong?
Would you say that if I replace the black hole by a star?
Well, as long as... To result in a contradiction with the signal, you have to say something about, you know, Bob can't signal to Alice.
Yeah, so it's not really the relative acceleration between... I use the Bob to basically determine that there must be an effect on Alice. But if you noticed in the talk, I didn't analyze Bob. I mean, it's just any measurement of the electromagnetic field in that region. You know, if it can distinguish two different states of Alice's particle going to the right or left, it will decohere. The relative acceleration of the experimental apparatus used is not going to be relevant, particularly.
Radiation is the key.
It's really the fact that any measurement of the electromagnetic field at space-like separation, that can distinguish two possible states of the electromagnetic field, cannot causally influence Alice, and therefore Alice must be decohered by a commensurate amount on her own, even if you don't make a measurement. So it doesn't matter that Bobs are there. Like, the Bob is irrelevant. The Bob is just there to tell you that there must be an effect. But it's not, the Bob need not make a measurement in order for Alice to, it just must be the case that she must be decohered as if someone was making them. I mean, in order for the theory to be consistent.
On your last point, there's some interpretational issues to be settled down before I can agree, but I'm happy with what you said. I think you answered my original question. Thank you.
No problem.
So just to compare your result with, say, Penrose's proposal of gravitationally induced decoherence. So in that case, the statement would be that all decoherence can be caused by some kind of gravitational effects.
Well, I think there's two things. One is that Penrose would say it doesn't matter what the what's happening around. Like, it's just you make a superposition and somehow by some modification of quantum mechanics it's decohered. And it's not a, like, this is a first principles derivation of an actual effect without any modification of quantum mechanics. The Penrose's thing is a modification of quantum mechanics to be able to, you know, to say that any superposition is decoherent. He would say that even in flat space time, if you make a superposition, it would just fundamentally be decoherent. I'm not saying that at all.
I'm just comparing that what you're saying is that some gravitational effect, like the presence of a horizon, can lead to decoherence.
Yeah.
Which is different from what his statement is, that any decoherence would be caused by just changing quantum mechanics due to the presence of gravitational.
Yeah, he would say that you make a superposition, you've now set a clock, and at some point, given the mass and the size of the superposition, it's going to be decohered after at a certain amount of time. And I'm not making any illusions that what I'm saying is supportive or against what he's saying. I'm saying that this is we just said there must be an effect. Where is the effect? And the effect is that the black hole absorbs which path information via the soft emission of the superposition.
Last question. So just maybe just so I understand that in the end, your answers only really depend on like the dipole moment of the fact that where the charge was versus superposition. So I would imagine you could have instead said like, let's literally look at a spin superposition, say like the subleading to the Coulomb field.
Yeah.
Of a spinning charge particle.
Yes.
And you literally get to the decoherence of like the spin states or something like that.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So it's subleading. It's slower just because the spin is the field of a spinning body is going to fall off at a slower.
In the sense that like
right. No, it's slower in the sense that it just falls off in powers of distance slow. Yeah.
Situation, the difference between the charge being here versus here is the same order as like a dipole moment. So you could have just as well said like a spinning neutron star near a black hole is going to decohere, right?
But it's not a single spinning. You need a superposition of spins,
sure.
Right? And that superposition of spins.
Is that guaranteed? I thought sometimes.
It's not obvious, actually. Let me say it's not obvious, actually, that it's not bigger or smaller off the top of my head. Yeah.
Both pretty big magnetic fields, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree.
As long as it's a dipole, you can actually do that better.
Yeah. That's an interesting question.
Okay. Everybody's there tomorrow. We'll ask him more questions and this afternoon, I guess, and let's thank God for his time. Thank you very much.